Ladies and gentlemen, please welcome an assistant professor at Harvard Medical School and the director of the Advanced Acne Therapeutics Clinic at the Brigham and Women's Hospital, Dr. John Barbier.
I knew they'd do a virtual introduction. I knew there's going to be music in it. All right. So in this talk today, I want to cover a couple of different areas. We'll talk about managing mild acne to start. Then we'll talk about more moderate to severe acne. What do we do there? And then we'll move on to rosacea. We'll talk about how do we classify rosacea, because this is actually really important for how we think about treating rosacea. So let's start with kind of how do you manage mild to moderate acne. Now, the key question here that always comes up is like, what is the best topical treatment for acne? And a challenge is we really don't have the data we'd want to know. We'd love to have trials that is like, how does adapalene do versus tretinoin or trifferatine or tazarotene lotion? How does minocycline foam do against clindamycin? Where does clascoterone or antiandrogens fit into all of this? But sadly, we're really missing most of this data. When we look at active comparator trials in acne, they're actually getting less common over time, and they're almost never performed. And so what can we do? Well, kind of the next best thing we can do is do what's called a network meta-analysis. Let's say we don't have a study comparing clindamycin to something like adapalene, and we want to know which one would work better, what's the difference in how well it works, and what side effects it has. Well, since we don't have that trial, we do have some others we could use to help. They've both been compared with a vehicle. We have trials comparing clindamycin to benzoyl peroxide and adapalene to benzoyl peroxide. So maybe we could use those and kind of work through those different nodes that link these trials together to make our best guess of how would adapalene work compared to clindamycin. And a few of these have been done. This is a recent one from about a year and a half ago. This was done in the UK. So one of the first things you'll notice is that a lot of treatments that we use in the United States aren't there. And that's because they're not available in the UK and they wanted to focus on treatments that are relevant for their population. But what we can see here, this is kind of the summary thing that happens out of a network meta-analysis called a SUCRA. It's basically like, if we made our best guess, which treatment's going to work best for the average patient, here it is. And you can see in this review, they thought that adapalene plus benzoyl peroxide would be the most effective treatment about 60% of the time. It was the most likely to be the best. Next was tretinoin. That was the next one. And then you started to have things like clindamycin, benzoyl peroxide, clindamycin, tretinoin, benzoyl peroxide, and kind of clindamycin lower down. So this gives us some general sense for at least these treatments, which ones work the best. But what if I want to use something else that's not on this list? Where do they fit? And so I want to go through some of the data for a few of these different treatments. So one of the first ones I want to talk about is clascoterone. When we think about our classic acne treatments, we're always thinking about retinoids, benzoyl peroxide, antibiotics. Clascoterone's kind of cool. It's a topical antiandrogen. We've never had a topical treatment like this that was commercially available. And you can use it in both men and women. So this is the first time we've really ever been able to use antiandrogen therapy for our male patients with acne. It's rapidly metabolized to cortexolone, so unlike something like spironolactone, we don't have to worry about systemic effects from it from an antiandrogen standpoint. If you're treating a 14-year-old boy with this, you do not have to worry that it's going to mess up any of their androgens or anything like that. And that's why we can use it in both men and women. And what's nice about it is it really gets at the fundamental drivers of acne. I would tell you all acne is hormonal. Whether you are a 16-year-old boy or a 35-year-old woman, hormones are playing a role in your acne. And that's because if we look at how acne happens, this is why it starts in puberty, testosterone, DHEAS, locally converted to 5-DHT, those turn on our sebaceous gland. And when our sebaceous gland's active, more sebum, more oil is being formed. That's food for acne bacteria, so they're gonna eat it up and proliferate and cause inflammation. That's gonna help clog, that's gonna make those keratinocytes in our skin get clogged up. That's gonna block the pores. And so for any patient, if we can help address that fundamental driver of androgens, that's a potentially effective treatment. So let's look at the data for clascoterone. When we look at the phase 3 clinical trials, it works pretty well. There are about 20% rates of IGA success, about 12% higher than vehicle. And we'll see some other trials, and I'd say this is on par or better than a lot of the other things we're going to see today. It particularly worked well for inflammatory lesions. There is a 45% decrease in those, so papules and pustules. A little bit less so for vehicle. For comedonal lesions are open and closed comedones, whiteheads, blackheads, but still work there, was still better than vehicle. And what's really cool about this is there are basically no side effects. In my experience, it can cause some flaring when people start it, and that's not on the trials or in the insert, but I do think that can happen, but it's not irritating. It doesn't cause photosensitivity. It's a relatively well-tolerated medication compared to many of our other topicals. It is twice a day medicine, so that is in some ways a side effect. It's a bit more inconvenient to use than some other things, but I think it's a nice addition to our armamentarium. One important side effect just to know about, not necessarily because it's a big deal, but because people might talk about it, is adrenal suppression. As I mentioned, this gets metabolized to cortexolone in the skin, and cortexolone is like a steroid hormone. So in theory, if you got a lot of that in your body, it might impact your HPA axis. And in a phase 2 trial where they had people use 6 grams a day, if you think about a 60-gram tube, you'd be done with it in 10 days. Just think about how much that is. But when people use 6 grams a day, about 7% of them had biochemical evidence of HPA axis suppression. Nobody had symptoms. Nobody had issues in the phase 3 trials. I think for normal use of this, like on someone's face, it's not going to be an issue. But if someone's using a lot of it, it's something to consider. They did, in the phase 2 studies, do a comparison with tretinoin, and this is the results of it. The black line is the clascoterone, and that gray one is tretinoin. And you can actually see that it did a little bit better than tretinoin, which is interesting to see. It might be at least on par with it, and if not a little bit better. And that's helpful data to have when we're thinking about this medication. So it's a medicine that I think does have a role, and we'll talk about it more, how to put it together toward the end, but I think it's a nice new option that we have. We've also got some new retinoid formulations. There's trifarotene, which is a fourth generation retinoid. It's very potent, it's very selective for the retinoic acid gamma receptor. And it's FDA approved to 9, and this is actually an advantage of newer treatments in general, is that they're FDA approved to 9. So if you treat pediatric patients, sometimes they're easier to get covered than some of the older drugs that might only be approved at 12. When we look at the clinical trials, like most retinoids, we see that it works a little better for comedonal lesions on the bottom than for inflammatory lesions in the middle. I think that's pretty typical. You see nice rates of IGA success. They're about 10, 15% better than vehicle. I think it's a little bit similar to what we saw in clascoterone. They also looked at the trunk, which was a cool thing about their study. Most topical retinoid studies and actually most acne trials don't do this. And you see it works for truncal acne too. I think we'd expect that. I think many of us have used retinoids like tazarotene or others for truncal acne for many years. So not necessarily surprising, but nice to see it in a clinical trial. Unfortunately, a challenge with trifarotene is it's not that tolerable. And I think we see this with retinoids. Retinoids that are very potent tend to be less tolerable unless you do something about the vehicle to try to minimize that. And trifarotene we see compared to things like tazarotene lotion, adapalene, it is not very tolerable. It's much more irritating. And in the phase 3 data, a quarter of people had issues with erythema scaling or dryness, at least moderate or severe. So I do think a limiting factor of trifarotene, both when you look at the data and in my own experience, is it's very irritating compared to other retinoids. And unfortunately, we don't have any trials showing it works better. So from my standpoint, we know it's more irritating, we know it's more expensive, and we don't know it works better. And so I tend not to use it very much. I prefer other options. What about better vehicles? These are a little bit older data, but I do think some of these lotion formulations can help with tolerability. When you look at tretinoin lotion, similar rates of IGA success, and tazarotene lotion, nicely they compared it to tazarotene cream, and they showed you could get similar efficacy with lower side effects. So I do think these lotion formulations can be helpful for patients who have trouble tolerating retinoids. Most patients can tolerate a retinoid if started slowly enough and thoughtfully, but for patients who can't tolerate it, even with that, I do sometimes use these, and I do think they can be very helpful. We have some new antibiotics. We've got minocycline foam. It does work. You can see like IGA success, maybe 5 to 10% better than vehicle. I don't think maybe it works as well as clascoterone or topical retinoids, but certainly it can be helpful. It has very low side effects, as you might expect from a topical antibiotic. That's generally what we see. But again, I have no idea. Does this work better than clindamycin? Does this work better than dapsone? What I do know is it's more expensive. So until I see those kind of data, it's something that I tend not to use unless they've failed other topical antibiotics first. This also, in my experience, it's kind of like a lime creamy foam, and it's not the most cosmetically elegant to use, and a lot of people don't necessarily like how it feels on the skin or looks. So what do I do? How do I put all of this information together? Well, the first thing is I really try to keep it simple. So many people are trying to do these like 10-step, really complicated regimens that have a lot of ingredients in them that are maybe not that high value. And so my first thing is like, let's simplify. Let's focus on the things that we know work. Because if you're doing a 10-thing process, often that's gonna be hard to be consistent with and to be able to succeed with. So I'd rather you did 3 things really well than 10 things not so consistently, or you end up with interactions between different products where they don't work or they pill. I usually start with something like generic adapalene or adapalene benzoyl peroxide. Really easy to get covered, very cost effective, and they work really well. A nice thing I like about adapalene is that it can be used with benzoyl peroxide. You don't have to stress, like, might they be mixing their tretinoin with benzoyl peroxide and somehow in their regimen it's not working. You don't have to worry about photolability. You can use it in the morning or evening, so it's more convenient for people who might want to do their stuff in the morning than at night. So I like to use adapting the start. Some insurances prefer Tretinoin. In my mind, that's fine. And then the nice other thing about Adapalene, if it's not covered, just go get Differin. If you prescribe, you know, Adapalene 0.1% with benzoyl peroxide not covered, use Differin and then over-the-counter benzoyl peroxide. You have a nice, easy, sensible backup plan that you can do. And then for people who can't tolerate those retinoids, that's where I often use something like tazarotene lotion, or for truncal acne, where you might need a stronger retinoid, that's kind of my go-to there. If someone has more inflammatory acne or just more severe acne, then I might add something like clindamycin lotion. Sometimes I'll use Dapsone, especially if people have like scalp folliculitis. I think it can work really well there, but I usually start with clindamycin. It's generic, it's easy to get, and sometimes you can even do clindamycin Tretinoin if you want to try to simplify things and you don't want to use like a Adapalene benzoyl peroxide. You can do like a benzoyl peroxide wash and then the clindamycin Tretinoin combination product. Because we know in clinical trials that giving people simpler regimens, combination products improves adherence and thus improves outcomes. For patients who have maybe more of a hormonal component, like their acne flares with their menstrual cycle, or you've done other topicals and it's not enough and they need just a little bit more, that's where I think clascoterone can be really nice. In my experience, it's super hard to get covered, which is a big challenge with it, but it is something that complements the rest of our acne therapies and can be a really useful option for our patients. So it's something that I do think is very helpful, and I do use it somewhat regularly. And then we don't want to forget other acne-associated sequelae like hyperpigmentation or erythema. And that's where things like tranexamic acid, which can help with both redness and pigmentation, can be useful. You can use things like alpha agonists, like oxymetazoline, for acne-associated erythema. Sometimes I'll mix that with tranexamic acid together and compound it. You can, for hyperpigmentation, use things like tranexamic acid and azelaic acid, since they both have a little bit of anti-acne properties too, which is great. I tend to use things like hydroquinone less, because if you don't really get it right on the acne spot, you can end up with halos, and that often doesn't look so great, and it's very hard to use so precisely. I find azelaic acid and tranexamic acid much more forgiving. And then glycolic acid or salicylic acid, often you can do them as toners or chemical peels, can be a nice other strategy that both have anti-acne benefits and can help address pigmentation. So now moving on to more moderate to severe acne. This is where we're going to be thinking about our oral antibiotics, hormonal therapy like birth control pills and combined oral contraceptives, and isotretinoin. So I want to start by just setting the stage. When we think about how do we treat moderate to severe acne, we prescribe a lot of antibiotics. We're actually the number one prescriber of antibiotics of any specialty in medicine, dermatology. And what is that used for? 60% is for acne, which is a non-infectious condition. Like, just thinking about that, talking to infectious disease doctors, we're like, what is going on here? But, you know, it's a helpful treatment. And when we look at it, we often prescribe it for long courses, often 6 to 12 months or more, and we prescribe it for many patients. It's the most commonly prescribed systemic treatment. So we have a new option here that maybe can help us with some of these problems of antibiotic stewardship and sarecycline. And the general principle of sarecycline is like, let's take doxycycline, minocycline, let's make it great at acne, let's make it as bad as possible at all the other bacteria, with the goal being to try to limit off-target effects that we wouldn't want to have happen on the microbiome. And when we look at it, it certainly has great efficacy against C. acnes. These data has something called MIC, or minimum inhibitory concentration. And what that means is, like, how much antibiotic does it take to kill the bacteria? If you want to kill them, you want a low number. If you want to leave them alone, you want a high number, because that means it's not going to do much to them. And you can see sarecycline's on par with doxycycline, minocycline. It has a very similar MIC for those, very effective against them. But it's less active against some gram-positives. You can see it's about two to four-fold higher for things like staph and strep. So, like, if we look at that top line for sarecycline, the MIC is 0.5. For doxycycline, it's 0.12. So you can see it's higher than doxycycline. It's not going to hurt those as much. But I don't know how clinically meaningful that is. It's not a big number. For our gut bacteria, it is a lot higher. You know, 8 to 16-fold sometimes higher, maybe even a little bit more than that, 32-fold sometimes, sarecycline compared to doxycycline and minocycline. So it does seem less sensitive to the gut microbiome. That might help improve the microbiome, though it's something that really has not ever been studied in a person. And what matters there is, like, our gut, the medicine hasn't, like, gone through your body yet. So the concentrations are super high in your gut compared to in your blood or maybe in your skin. So we don't really know what it does to an actual person, but at least theoretically it has certainly some strengths over doxycycline and minocycline. How well does it work? When we look at the clinical trials, you see about 10% difference between placebo and sarecycline for IGA success. I remember clascoterone at the beginning was 10% too, but certainly works. It's excellent for inflammatory lesions like most oral antibiotics are. a little bit less so for comedonal lesions, again, like most oral or topical antibiotics are. And it's very tolerable. I mean, if you want to think about that microbiome argument, these data sort of support it, and that very few patients experience GI side effects. Now, that may just be how the way the trial was done. Like, maybe they were less sensitive in saying someone has a GI side effect than in the doxycycline studies. But nevertheless, the incidence in this trial was very low for GI side effects. There are very low rates of yeast infections. There was no evidence of photosensitivity, though they do have some other studies looking at photosensitivity. And in my experience, too, it's probably a little bit photosensitizing. It might be less than doxycycline, but it's not zero, I think. And there are no vestibular side effects, so nothing like you see with minocycline. So I wanted to shift gears a little bit, because we talked about, could sarecycline help us with this antibiotic stewardship issue? Another thing that we often see is this idea of low dose, or sometimes it's called submicrobial dosing. And I want to go into this a little bit. Let's think about what are the key assumptions of this argument, and do we actually meet them? So the first assumption is that the doses we're using are below that minimum inhibitory concentration, right? We were talking about if you have you go below the MIC, you're not actually hurting the bacteria. And so the idea of this submicrobial dosing is you stay below the MIC or far below it, the bacteria kind of ignore it. They don't need to develop resistance. And then the second part of this is actually that being below the MIC reduces the rate of resistance. That's an assumption there too, that being around antibiotics, not being killed by them, leads the bacteria to not develop resistance. And we'll go look at both of these. So first is the concentration below the MIC. This is the figure that everyone talks to when they say that low-dose doxycycline is below the MIC. You know what's interesting? On that y-axis, they don't say what bacteria that is, right? We just looked at all this data for sarecycline, and MIC is a species-specific thing. The MIC for staph is going to be different than C. acnes, than strep, or E. coli. I don't even know what this bacteria is. In the paper, they never mention it. So the first thing is, this is something, but it might not be all the bacteria, just one. So we haven't really shown that these low doses are actually below the MIC. We've shown it for one bacteria in the blood. What about in other compartments? We talked about in the gut, it's going to be a lot higher. We know oral antibiotics are associated with inflammatory bowel disease and colon cancer. So are we actually having lower concentrations in the gut? No one's ever shown that for low-dose antibiotics. It is an unknown question. And then the second part, are these low doses okay? Well, here's some data they might not be. If you ask Alexander Fleming, who developed penicillin, are low-dose antibiotics okay? He was actually afraid that patients might be underdosed by their doctors, and that would promote resistance. And here we're intentionally doing that with the goal of not creating resistance. And when we look at the in vitro data, if you give bacteria a lower dose of antibiotic, you actually make them more likely to develop resistance than if you kill them with the antibiotic. And that kind of makes sense. If you're seeing enough antibiotic, it's stressing you out, but you're not dead from it, well, you're going to try and put up barriers to protect yourself from that stress. You're going to develop resistance. And then when we look in vivo, right, that's ultimately care about what happens to people. Well, here's a trial on low-dose antibiotic. I love the title. Long-term use of submicrobial dose doxycycline does not lead to change in antibiotic susceptibility. Look at this graph. So here they gave patients about a year of 20 milligrams, 10 milligrams, or 20 milligrams twice a day of doxycycline or placebo. You can see at baseline, nobody has any resistance. At 12 months, look, even 20 milligrams once a day, look at that incredible rise in resistance. Fortunately, over time, it did go back, which is great. But clearly, that antibiotic is impacting the microbiome. There's absolutely something happening there. It's an incredible discrepancy between the data and the conclusions. So what do I do? How do I incorporate all this information? Well, first off, from an antibiotic stewardship standpoint, I try to focus more on limiting the number of patients I treat rather than limiting the duration. And the reason for this is when we look at microbiome changes, and this has been studied by a few people like Anna Chien, the changes to the microbiome happen fast. They happen in a few weeks. There's nothing in my mind where like 2.9 months, you're good, 3.1 months, you're bad. There's no data to support that. And so I worry much less about how long and just the decision to do it at all. If you do it at all, you're going to impact someone's microbiome, even with low-dose antibiotics. What's the significance of that? We don't fully know, but it's probably not great. And so I think hard about, does this patient need an antibiotic, or is there something else I could use instead? And when I do start, if it's the right medicine for them, I don't go like, oh, you've been on it for 3 or 6 months, we've got to stop. We stop because we think you might not need it anymore. Maybe we've got something else on board now that's going to help us get off of it. Maybe your acne's gotten less so we can stop it. But if you just stop someone's antibiotics, you know what's going to happen? Their acne's going to come back. It's going to be whatever it's going to be if they had never gotten it. And so unless they're done with having acne because they've aged out of it, you're going to end up putting them right back on that a month later. And you're just going to yo-yo on and off, on and off. And so I think a lot more about who do I treat than how long. I often just use doxycycline, 100 milligrams once or twice a day. And the reason I do this, easy to get covered. It has similar efficacy to minocycline, but it's clearly safer. There's no risk of DRAS or severe drug reactions. There's no risk of vestibular changes. And that's a big issue. Like, people have died who've been treated with acne with minocycline or with Bactrim, trimethoprim, sulfamethoxazole. To me, like, for someone who has acne, which I have tons of treatment options to do, to give you anything that might make you die, that, like, puts you at higher risk of than something else is something I don't feel comfortable with. So I really basically never use minocycline in the treatment of acne or rosacea for that reason. There's no evidence that it works better. It might, but there's certainly no evidence to support it. There's a Cochrane review that says it doesn't, and it has clear safety concerns with it. Sarecycline, I do think, is a nice option. It's a little hard to get covered, but for someone who's a bit more price insensitive and doesn't mind being on something more expensive, I do think it's kind of strictly superior to doxycycline. It clearly has less microbiome impact. It's less photosensitizing. It just seems like it's better, but I don't know if it's like $600 better for most people. So for someone who's not so cost sensitive, or for someone who maybe I know has more risk factors for antibiotic issues, like some gut health problems to start, or who I know is going to be on antibiotics for a long time, I might go for it, but often I just start with doxycycline. All right, so we talked about antibiotics, but as I mentioned a couple times, like, the best thing would be, could we just not use them? Our patients want to not be on antibiotics most of the time. I'd love for people to not be on antibiotics, and I'm sure the CDC would like for dermatologists to stop being number one at prescribing antibiotics. So this is actually some data from a patient survey of about 1,000 patients who were being treated for acne with antibiotics, and 75% would prefer a non-antibiotic treatment if possible. I think that makes sense. No one's really psyched to be on an antibiotic most of the time these days. And what's interesting is only 30% actually had any idea that there were non-antibiotic options. And I'm sure part of this is just patients forget stuff. You tell them things and they don't remember. But it really highlights that there's a gap between what we're doing, what patients want to be educated about, and what's actually kind of happening from their perspective. So, you know, our classic hormonal therapy, spironolactone, great option. Look at these pictures. This is just monotherapy of spironolactone to go from that to that. That's pretty impressive. And although we don't have randomized controlled trials, although I'm going to talk about one that just came out, in general, we have very little randomized controlled trial data about spironolactone, we've got a ton of case series looking at it where it can be really highly effective. I just want to highlight this one in the middle, the ISFI-Joubert study. In this study, 71% of patients had a good clinical response to spironolactone. And among them, 60% had previously relapsed after isotretinoin. So these are patients with severe acne who aren't really able to stay clear with isotretinoin. And many of them are getting better with just spironolactone, which I think is pretty impressive. We also tried to look at this question of, which I think is a key one, and we're looking at this with a trial right now that I hope will come out eventually. We've recruited about a quarter of the patients for it. But this idea of, like, well, a big choice we have is, like, spironolactone or oral antibiotics. Spironolactone or oral antibiotic, which one's best? We know spironolactone might have some advantages, oral antibiotics might have some advantages and weaknesses, but which works better? That's ultimately what a lot of our patients care about. And this is some observational data. It's not a trial, but it's kind of the next best thing. We looked at patients who started either spironolactone or doxycycline, and then we looked over the next year, how many of them stayed on the treatment, with the assumption being if you switched to the other one or to isotretinoin, that meant whatever you got started on didn't work. And we found that there were similar rates of switching after controlling for things like PCOS, combined oral contraceptive use, other acne treatments that might modulate that outcome. We found there are similar rates of switching, whether you got started on spironolactone or oral antibiotics. So it seems like it has similar effectiveness to oral antibiotics, that if, you know, you're wondering which one's best, they're about the same. And now we actually have a clinical trial, our first one, our first big one. This was in the UK called the SAFA trial. This truly came out like 3 weeks ago. I submitted the slides and then added it in again. And it was a pragmatically designed study. So what that means is, like, they tried to reflect real-world practice. People could be on other medications. They could really do anything they wanted outside the study. They were 18 or older. They had to have at least kind of mild acne for 6 months. And in these groups, again, they could kind of do whatever else they wanted regimen-wise. The study design was a little bit funny. So they started people on 50 milligrams for 6 weeks of spironolactone. And if they were doing okay side effect-wise, they had the option to go up to 100 milligrams at that 6 week until the end of the study at 24 weeks. And as we're going to talk about, that might have been a suboptimal way to set this up that can make it a little harder to show outcomes in such a short study. And then the other group got just placebo. The primary outcome, which is interesting, was the acne qual, so a patient-reported outcome, not an IGA score, not a lesion count. And I think this reflects actually having a patient-centered trial design. Like, if you ask acne patients, what do they care about? They, not surprisingly, care about patient-reported outcomes. They care about, what is my lived experience of acne, right? That's kind of what we should be aiming for, to improve their life, not to improve how many pimples I count on them. And what they found was at 12 weeks, they're about the same still. And I think this has to do with starting at such a low dose. But then at 24 weeks, you could see a real significant difference between those who are randomized to spironolactone or placebo. This study also, I think, is really helpful from a side effect standpoint. Because unlike all our other studies where we're just like, we treated 100 people and we listened to what they said and we don't know, like, do they just have headaches because they have migraine and has nothing to do with the medicine? Here we can actually compare in a controlled study the side effects. And we see really the main ones. So we talk a lot about irregular periods. But interestingly, in the study, in which agreeably, you know, about 30 or 40% of people were on birth control pill, which may modulate this, but most people didn't have irregular periods. There's really no significant difference between the acne spironolactone group and the placebo group. But we did see that the spironolactone group was about 5% more likely, 7% more likely to have dizziness, lightheadedness. And we know, you know, that can be an issue. It is a blood pressure medicine. They were about 8% more likely to have headache, which is, I think, a side effect we don't often counsel patients about, but clearly, you know, was a side effect in this study. So I think that's a helpful data point. And interestingly, not that many patients compared about polyuria between the two groups is about the same. I do think that probably is something that happens with it, but at least this study kind of highlights it's probably not a big deal most of the time. So I think really helpful, actually, data from a side effect standpoint to counsel patients. You know, you might have lightheadedness, you might have headache. You're probably not going to have irregular periods with the doses we tend to use for acne, and you're probably not going to have many other side effects. So that's really helpful. But let me just step back again. So again, a challenge with this is they use the patient report outcome as the primary measure here. And when you look at their IGA success rates in the study, which they did too, they were fivefold higher than the rate of success when they were looking at acne qual. And I think that highlights that it's really hard to meet endpoints from just like a trial power and responsiveness using patient report outcomes. Because just think about it. You've got 400 people in the study. There are 400 like investigators who might interpret it differently. They've had no training on how to do it compared to like the 20 actual study trial investigators who are dermatologists. They've been trained how to do lesion counts to standardize things. It's going to be a lot harder to show a change and an effect where there's just a lot of baseline variability in how do people interact with it. The other challenge of the study that I mentioned is that starting at 50 milligrams. So, you know, if you're at 50 milligrams until week 6, and then you just look 6 weeks later, it's really hard to show an effect because we know spironolactone is a slow medicine. So looking 6 weeks after you started effectively, you truly get to 100 milligrams is just too soon. 98% of people went from 50 to 100 milligrams. So if you were going to do a future study, you probably should start at least 100 milligrams because most people tolerated that. 95% of people at the end of the study were still on 100 milligrams. That's probably an optimal starting dose for people with acne. Another common issue that comes up with spironolactone is the risk of cancer. You know, could it put people at increased risk of breast cancer or other cancers? We conducted a systematic review and meta-analysis looking at all of the studies that have ever looked at this, over 30 million person years of follow-up. It doesn't seem like there's really a meaningfully increased risk of breast cancer. I do worry a little bit about ovarian cancer. You can see there's no significant difference, but that's a really wide confidence interval. There's definitely a potential for that to be an issue. And I think if someone has like a BRCA mutation, especially where they're already at a really high risk of ovarian cancer, I would worry about that. And I'd be careful about that population or strong family history of ovarian cancer. But breast cancer, I don't worry about so much. Even people who've had a history of breast cancer in their family or even personally, I think is reasonable to consider this medicine. Lab monitoring is another thing that comes up a lot, potassium monitoring. And what Aras Mostaghimi and now some other groups have shown is that really there's no need for potassium monitoring in young, healthy people. There's some of this like under 45, it's fine, over 45, it's not type of a thing. And that's really just arbitrary the way the studies were designed. So I don't like you're 44 and it's fine, you're 46, it's bad. It's a little bit like that antibiotic thing. I view it more like a gradient. And so if you're older age, if you have other comorbidities that might increase your risk for hyperkalemia, if you're on drugs that might increase your risk for it, then we think about checking it. And it's really like a shared decision making with the patient. You know, I have people who are more anxious and we check it when they're 35. I have people who really hate lab draws and they're 50 and we don't. So I think just being thoughtful about that, knowing that as you get older, you are maybe at higher risk, and being a bit more fluid with how to think about it is the way I approach it. Another thing I just want to touch on that, which will go into this a bit too, is this issue that I get from pharmacists all the time. I don't know if you've done this too, where you give someone a drospirenone containing combined oral contraceptive and spironolactone, and then they call you and they're like, that's crazy, you can't do that, you're going to kill the person from hyperkalemia. And all of the data we have looking at risk of hyperkalemia when you combine drospirenone containing combined oral contraceptive with spironolactone suggests not meaningful increased risk. No need to be stressed about it. And on top of that, drospirenone is like the equivalent of like 25 milligrams of spironolactone. So if you'd be fine going from 100 milligrams of spironolactone to 125 milligrams of spironolactone, there's really not a need to worry about the drospirenone. But I probably get at least like one or two calls a week from some pharmacy that's like, you can't do that. And then I have to explain it to them. So if you've experienced that too, there's a couple of studies that support that's not an issue. So combined oral contraceptives, another hormonal therapy to think about, they definitely seem like they have some efficacy. And again, our question of are they as good or better than antibiotics? Well, this is, again, like the best we have. We don't have a real trial, but we do have this meta-analysis to try to put together trials that were looking at combined oral contraceptives and oral antibiotics. And what they found was at 3 months, it does look like the oral antibiotics were better. They had a greater reduction in inflammatory lesions than with the combined oral contraceptives. But at 6 months, they were the same. And I think that makes sense. We know antibiotics are pretty fast, and we know hormonal therapies are pretty slow. So this is kind of interesting that, you know, if you're wondering, like, hey, how will combined oral contraceptives work? They might work pretty darn similarly to oral antibiotics, even though we often don't think of them as like a strong acne treatment. But they might be better than we think, especially if we're able to be patient, or we can use them as a therapy that we start together with antibiotics to transition off the antibiotic. What are the risks of it? I think a lot of people, I'm just curious, like in the room, who here prescribes combined oral contraceptives ever for your patients? So some people, but not a lot, actually. And I think this is a common thing in dermatology. We're like really afraid to prescribe these. And what I want to try to do by the end of this is see if I can convince some of you that it's okay to prescribe these, that we can do it. So let's just talk about like what are the risks, right? So we're going to prescribe something. We want to really understand the side effect profile of the drug. So combined oral contraceptives, they are associated with an increased risk of basically cardiovascular events, so thromboembolism, stroke, myocardial infarction. They can potentially worsen estrogen receptor positive malignancies, classically like breast cancer. So let's just think about these risks a little bit in some more detail. So let's start with the breast cancer risks. I think that comes up a lot when you're talking to patients. So first off, there's not necessarily convincing evidence that there is an increased risk of breast cancer. Studies conflict, but I'd say if you kind of look at them all together, maybe there is a slightly higher risk around a relative risk of 1.2. And that's a relative risk. What about the absolute risk? So if you imagine treating patients with combined oral contraceptive, if you treated 100,000 patients for a year, you'd create 13 cases of breast cancer, potentially. That's like the attributable risk. So that's not a very big risk. Like your likelihood of going from not having breast cancer to having breast cancer when you get a combined oral contraceptive is very minimal. In addition, combined oral contraceptives reduce risk of other cancers like colon cancer, uterine cancer, and ovarian cancer, which the last one can be very difficult to treat. So the overall cancer risk is actually lower when you look at just gynecologic malignancies as a whole. There's a 29% reduction in gynecologic malignancies. So if you're like, I'm scared of birth control pill because I'm worried about cancer, really it's probably a net benefit or at least pretty much neutral. So it's something that I don't think is a major concern for most people. Another thing, again, about side effects is like, well, who shouldn't get them? We talked about these cardiovascular side effects, these breast cancer side effects. Like, what patients should I be afraid to give these to? And the big one is migraine with aura. Like when you think about our acne population, it's like migraine with aura is who you don't want to give it to. Because people have not just regular migraine, but migraine with aura where they get like those premonitory symptoms, either visual or other sensory. Those patients are at increased risk of stroke or other major cardiovascular events. So that's a population you want to be careful with. People who smoke a lot and are over 35, that's probably not that many people, but that's another one to think about. People who do have hypertension, it does raise people's blood pressure, so that's another thing to be careful about. Most young, healthy women don't have hypertension, but it's worth just like checking their blood pressure, or, you know, if they have their PCPs checked in, it's been fine. I don't really worry about that too much. Of course, someone who has blood clots, you wouldn't want to give it to because it can increase the risk of blood clots, but again, that's pretty rare in young, healthy people. And then people who have hepatic dysfunction or ER-positive cancer, again, usually in young, healthy patients with acne, not an issue, but it is something worth thinking about. Those might be settings where you want to involve their gynecologist. Again, most of these things, not a problem for most of our patients. Now, how do you start it? Like, do they need like a pap smear and all these tests or things? Really, no. You can either just start it on basically right when they're after their cycle, or really anytime you think pregnancy is reasonably excluded. And one way to do this is a pregnancy test, or you know, if you just they have an IUD or something, you trust them, you could do that too. You don't need to do a pregnancy test before you start it. And now there's no mandatory pap smears or pelvic exams to start a combined oral contraceptive when you look at the ACOG guidelines. So it's really, as a dermatologist, you can do this. It's not too scary. It can really help your patients, both for their acne, and if you're prescribing like a teratogenic medication, like you're giving them cyclosporine and you're giving them isotretinoin for acne, like we should feel comfortable using these because we prescribe so many teratogens and because they're actually a really helpful treatment for things like acne and hidradenitis, which are common conditions that we see in our office. So we should feel okay with doing this. Absolutely, like it's great to get a gynecologist involved too. I often start these with people and I say like, if you wanna stay on it, you should work with your gynecologist to do that because I don't necessarily wanna be like doing contraception management. But I think we should feel comfortable at least starting them, even if we don't feel comfortable like managing them for years and years and years. And then finally, so we're talking about hormonal therapy. who is a candidate for hormonal therapy? Is it just like adult women with acne on their jawline? And I want to again try, if you're thinking that way, I want to try to make you rethink this a little bit. I want to give you some perspective. So if you look at adult women with acne and you compare them to adolescent women with acne and look at like their phenotype, about 90% of them, their acne phenotype looks just like adolescent acne. They don't just have jawline acne. They have kind of the same kind of acne that anyone else has. There are about 10% who do have that kind of mandibular jawline acne. I do think that's a thing. But most adult women with acne, who we often think about as like hormonal acne, they look just like adolescents. And as I mentioned earlier, all acne is hormonal. If all acne wasn't hormonal, how does class code room work in men, right? That just highlights, again, that anybody with acne is a candidate for hormonal therapy. It might not be the option they want to pick, that's fine, but anyone's a candidate for it. We shouldn't restrict it ourselves. We should let our patients choose. The other thing is that this idea of like mandibular acne, it doesn't predict things like PCOS or other signs of hyperandrogenemia. And so again, kind of highlighting that's not necessarily the best predictor of people who might benefit from hormonal acne. In this last part, I want to transition a bit to isotretinoin, and I want to talk about side effects. So when we think about isotretinoin, the most common side effect, dry skin, right? That's the big one. What we can use to help with that, and I recommend this to everyone, is omega-3s. So there are trials that show a gram a day of omega-3s helps reduce dryness by about 50% compared to placebo, which is great. It's simple. It's inexpensive. It's very safe. And it deals with one of the most meaningful side effects we see. And even better, it can actually help with ocular dryness as well, which is a huge problem. I actually worry that we often over-treat people with isotretinoin, and people do get chronic dry skin and chronic dry eye from isotretinoin, and so I do like to be thoughtful about that. If someone's having a lot of dryness or dry eye, that makes me maybe use a shorter course or think about doing other things, and omega-3s, fortunately, can help prevent dry eye. So again, for me, because chronic dryness is, in my mind, one of the most worrisome side effects, I actually do this for everybody. The other thing we can do that can help is antihistamines. This is kind of cool. So our sebocytes, our oil gland cells, actually have histamine receptors on them. And if you give a patient an antihistamine randomized controlled trial before they start isotretinoin, they're less likely to flare. And in fact, their acne gets better a little bit better, faster, and they're happier. And so antihistamines, really anyone, I don't think it matters. I usually do loratadine, but any antihistamine can help people do better with isotretinoin. So I strongly recommend omega-3. I present them the data and suggest that they take an antihistamine. And I think these can be helpful adjuvant therapies when we're doing isotretinoin. Another big question that comes up is like, do you need frequent labs? A lot of people don't like getting labs. I don't like getting labs. And when we think about monitoring, our goals should be to prevent side effects or to guide dosing. And do we do that when we check labs for isotretinoin? Right? Because we're giving people pain. We're giving them fear. They're like, oh my God, this medicine's scary. I have to get blood work. And it's expensive, especially if people have a high deductible health plan. So let's look at lipids, right? That's the main one we worry about. High triglycerides, maybe they're at risk of pancreatitis. Well, first off, lipid abnormalities, super rare. About 0.3% of people have them to a meaningful degree. And interestingly, when we looked at it, almost everybody just continues their isotretinoin course. They just check it again, and it's not high. They ate a hamburger before they checked it. The other key thing is, again, we're checking it because we're worried about pancreatitis. Well, guess what? There have only been 25 cases of pancreatitis reported ever. So think about that. There's probably been 20 million courses of isotretinoin, 25 cases of pancreatitis. What's the likelihood that you're actually going to protect someone? And even more importantly, only 12% of those cases of pancreatitis had high triglycerides. So if we're checking high triglycerides to try to prevent pancreatitis, and triglycerides don't predict risk of pancreatitis, is that helping? Is that achieving our goal of guiding dosing or preventing side effects? So the group who did a critically appraised topic for the British Journal of Dermatology said, don't bother checking lipids. It's not worth it. It doesn't make sense. The data just don't support it. LFTs, similar story. When you look at risks of LFT elevation, they're just as common at baseline as on treatment, which suggests kind of background noise. People have fatty liver disease, they drink alcohol, all of those kinds of things. I do think maybe they go up a little bit. Our data don't support that, but some other data do. Like, they go up a little bit and they go back down. But there's really no evidence that they go up to a meaningful degree or in a lasting way. And in fact, that same British Journal of Dermatology group, when they looked at LFTs, same thing. Really no cases of meaningful liver injury have ever been reported. And thus, again, they felt really there's no strong evidence to support LFT monitoring. Now, like, we live in the United States, there are lawsuits. I wouldn't just like never do labs on people or never offer labs, but I do think if you have a patient who they understand the evidence, they understand the risks, and they don't want to do labs, I think that's totally reasonable to do no labs. I often, like, my standard practice is like baseline and then at peak dose, because that's what our Delphi consensus group has said. But at the same time, I always offer people the opportunity to not do labs. Other things that come up, so neuropsychiatric side effects, depression. When you compare starting someone on isotretinoin to starting them on antibiotics, you know what? They're less likely to be depressed, less likely to take an antidepressant, less likely to go to the ER for suicidal ideation or self-harm. That's really compelling data. Like, isotretinoin is going to make you less likely to have these things. At a population level, though, at an individual level, there are people, right? They take it, they're depressed, you stop it, they're better, you take it again, it happens again. They get mood lability. That absolutely happens. So it doesn't mean we don't need to watch out for it. It doesn't mean we don't need to counsel about it. But in that counseling, the average effect that we expect is that they're going to become better because we treat their acne. We fix the thing that's making them sad. So what do I do for isotretinoin? I start around 0.3 to 0.5 milligrams per kilogram a day. And generally, I go on the lower side to try to minimize side effects. I encourage antihistamine, and I really strongly push the omega-3s. I increase it by about that amount each month over the next 1 or 2 months, depending on side effects. My goal is, like, you have some side effects, but they're tolerable. Like, you've got some dry skin, but you're not too bothered. And then I treat until they're clear for 2 or 3 months, and at least about 90 milligrams per kilogram for someone who clears really quickly. Because ultimately, when we look at relapse, right, that's what we care about with dosing. Cumulative dose, daily dose, don't matter. What matters is they get clear. And I think that's intuitively sensible. If you treat someone with like 220 milligrams per kilogram and they're not clear, they obviously are going to be not clear when you stop too. So you've got to think about those kinds of things. And again, I'll check lipids and LFTs at baseline and peak dose, though I will offer everyone no labs if they'd like. All right, in this next part, I want to move on to rosacea. And so when I think about rosacea, a lot of us, I think, classically thought of this like erythromatotelangiectatic, papular pustular, and phimatous rosacea. And I want to try to rethink that again with everyone today. I would rather we focus on morphology than these subtypes because you can have overlap, right? People can have papules and pustules and redness. And our treatments are very tied to phenotype, to morphology, not to subtype. So the main things I think about are redness stuff. So transient erythema, like flushing, persistent facial erythema, and then fixed, kind of like telangiectasias, vascular lesions. We think about inflammatory papules and pustules, so bumps, that's number two. And then we've got phimatous changes, you know, thickening of the nose and the sebaceous glands. And when we think about treatments, we're going to see how those morphologies rather than subtypes really guide what we do. So first, everyone with rosacea, if you look at this thing, it talks about, you know, this is from the Roscoe group, but what they recommend. Everybody, they recommend general skincare. And what is that? That's trying to avoid extreme temperatures. That's sun protection. We know UV is a big driver of rosacea, daily sun protection. There's all kinds of other triggers like food, alcohol, things like that. Those are pretty hard to avoid. Like, if someone's like, you can never exercise because it's going to make your rosacea worse, I'd be like, I'm not doing that. I'm going to keep exercising. So a lot of these are pretty hard to do in an actionable way, but it's helpful to let people know, like, you know, the reason your skin flushes when you do this is because you have rosacea. But most people aren't going to stop these things. I think the sun exposure is a good one. The minimizing, you know, huge changes in temperature, being thoughtful about picking non-irritating products, that's all important. I think a lot of the other ones are pretty hard. So let's go into these different morphologies. Let's start with redness. So someone comes in and they're bothered by the redness of their rosacea, what can they do? Well, the first thing is cosmetic camouflage, that's simple. If you use a green-tinted foundation or green-tinted sunscreen or other skincare products, that can help to mask the redness. And then you can do something else about that. So that's often a really nice starting place for someone who doesn't want to do anything too intense or expensive or hard, because unfortunately we don't have a lot of great treatments for redness. The other things we can do are vasoconstricting topicals, right? Redness, the blood vessels, too much blood flow. So let's tamp that down. And so we can use brimonidine or oxymetazoline. They both just provide temporary relief for redness. So people are like, am I like cured of redness? No, you have to keep doing it, unfortunately. And some people are like, well, what's the point? I just use like cosmetic camouflage. But they definitely can work. I prefer oxymetazoline because it has some evidence that it has less rates of rebound. Here's some data for both of them. So here's brimonidine. They give people brimonidine or they give them vehicle. And you can see in this that the number of people who kind of get to being improved is about twice as high for those who get brimonidine and those who don't. You can see it kind of wanes over time. Here's kind of photo evidence of the same thing. You can see before they get it, this person has some redness on the cheeks, then it's less, and then it gradually creeps back in. Oxymetazoline, same thing. You can see definitely works better than vehicle. You can see nice pictures. You know, same thing works. What's interesting is the oxymetazoline people, they did a 52-week study. I just want to point this out. It's kind of fascinating. So if you look at the far left, day one, you can see pre-dose, nobody's clear, right? That's why they're in the study, because they have redness. And about 60, 70% of them improve a few hours later. At week four now, though, 20% of people at baseline, before they put on the medicine, have, like, basically success. They're improved. At 26 weeks, 43%. At 52 weeks, 50%. It's kind of interesting, because I mentioned, like, oxymetazoline, we think of it as like it just helps for 8 to 10 hours, and then you got to keep doing it. But these data might suggest, you know, could it actually modify the course of rosacea? Could consistent use of a topical alpha agonist actually help, like maybe train the neurovascular system to not be so flushing? And so I always found this interesting, and actually for me, this is like a reason that I feel a little bit more optimistic that using something like oxymetazoline over time might have some additional benefits that just makes you look better for 8 to 10 hours. It might actually change the course of the disease a little bit. And then of course we've got our energy-based devices, pulse dye laser, KTP laser, and intense pulse light. These can provide more durable improvement in redness. You know, you do a few sessions of it, and things creep back in because the rosacea is still there, but they don't necessarily need to do it all the time. So that can be a nice feature of these. They're usually expensive. Some patients can't afford them, which is a challenge. And for whatever reason, I find this bizarre. You know, treating bumps of rosacea, almost everything is covered, at least if you go through step therapy. Treating redness of rosacea, almost never covered, no matter what. Why is that? Like, why do we only care about the bumps, not the redness? Probably has to do with, like, people view, like, symptom things as, like, treat and asymptomatic things as, like, quote-unquote cosmetic. Though people with redness often have burning and stinging, so I think it's an opportunity for us as a field to advocate better for our patients that, like, we need coverage of redness treatments too, like, that matters. Bumps, moving on. So again, we've got our redness treatments. Now if you've got bumps, what do we do for that? Well, these are kind of mostly antimicrobial things. It's a little bit like treating acne. We've got azelaic acid, metronidazole, ivermectin, minocycline foam, encapsulated benzoyl peroxide. A lot of the same stuff that pops up for acne, same kind of bump types of treatments. When we look at kind of comparing these, we can see actually that ivermectin works better than metronidazole. So if you had access to both and you were like, which should I start with? Ivermectin is more likely to get your patient clear than metronidazole. I think they do complement themselves a bit. Metronidazole is an antibiotic. Ivermectin is more of like an anti-parasite type of thing, Demodex mite idea. And so I think they can work well together. And often it's harder to get ivermectin first. So usually I'll start with metronidazole and then move on to ivermectin. But ivermectin strictly is superior in general in terms of how it works. We now have minocycline foam, so a topical antibiotic that we can use for patients with rosacea. I mean, look at these graphs, they're not that impressive in terms of, you know, change in lesion counts, IGA success. They're okay, it definitely works. It's pretty hard to get covered, just like when we see in the acne space. I don't think it's the most cosmetically elegant product. It's usually not my starting place, but I think it can be helpful. We have this encapsulated benzoyl peroxide now, which I think is really cool. So this is like you take benzoyl peroxide and you put it in these like silica micro like shells, and it makes it get released more slowly and more evenly. And so the theory of this is it helps reduce irritation when you're still giving basically the same amount of medicine, kind of like lotion formulations of retinoids. And you can see, like, very nice IGA success at week 12. That's like a, you know, 20-30% difference compared to vehicle. Works really well for inflammatory lesions. I think that's pretty impressive data. And what's really cool, it doesn't look like it's that irritating. Like, look at the rates of application site pain, erythema, 2% versus 1% with vehicle. That's pretty good. We were looking at trifferritin earlier, it's 25%. So, you know, this encapsulated benzoyl peroxide for people with rosacea skin who often can't tolerate benzoyl peroxides, I think this is a pretty nice option that we now have, and it complements the other things we do. It's different than the other things we do. So I'm pretty excited about this. It's hard to get covered, like most brand things, but sometimes you can if you've done some other stuff, and I do think it adds to our armamentarium for ways that we can treat rosacea bumps. I want to move on a bit to rhinophyma. So it's basically like Accutane, isotretinoin, and it's something you really want to be on top of because the only way you can get rid of it once it's happened is really destructive procedures like loop, electrocautery, sometimes laser, those kinds of things. So once it's there, just like an acne scar, there's really no going back without some kind of cosmetic procedure. So you really want to be aggressive in treating these patients. Isotretinoin is definitely the most effective treatment, but in this population, it's a little bit more challenging because they're usually older people. They're going to have more like lipid, hyperlipidemia, cardiovascular comorbidities is not as easy to use as in an 18-year-old, you know, boy. So, but it is really the best treatment you can do for early disease. So just to summarize, like, what do I do? So again, not subtypes, but morphology. So see the patient, you know, what bothers you? Is it redness? Is it bumps? Is it your nose is getting bigger? And then once you've got that down, you think about, okay, for redness, let's use our things like pulse dye laser, or things like oxymetazoline. For bumps, let's use our topical antimicrobial things, benzoyl peroxide, metronidazole, ivermectin. And then for phimatous changes, really, we want to start thinking about like isotretinoin or at least something like oral tetracycline. And then if you've got more severe disease, again, you're going to think about those oral tetracyclines like doxycycline or even maybe sarecycline now, and then isotretinoin. All right. So I try to leave a little bit of time for questions. Thanks, everyone, for your attention. You know, if you want to check out more content, I've got a bunch of things on Twitter, YouTube, and Instagram. How long after using topical clascoterone would you consider a treatment failure? And also, if I don't get to all of them now, I'll try to do more in the next part as well. I think like when you look at the clinical trial data, you see benefits after about 12 weeks. So if you've done clascoterone for 12 weeks and you're not where you want to be, either you need to add something to it or you need to think about something different would be the way I think about that. Do these work? I just push it, it goes? No. Specific OCPs known to be more helpful for acne. So certainly the main factor I would say is there's four generations of progestins in combined oral contraceptives, and the fourth generation ones like drospirenone are a little bit anti-androgenic. So most of these are actually androgenic. So like the reason when people get like a Nexplanon, they get more acne is that the levonorgestrel is a little bit pro-acne, whereas something like drospirenone is anti-acne. And so ones with drospirenone, like Yaz, Yasmin, Nikki, are probably like all else equal what I would go to. That being said, there's maybe a slightly higher risk of DVT and PE in people who get drospirenone-containing combined oral contraceptive. Often what people say is like, if you're just a person, like contraceptive-age woman, your risk is about 3 per 10,000. You add a birth control pill, it's 6 per 10,000. And then drospirenone is somewhere between 6 and 9 per 10,000. So it's not much higher. You're very unlikely to have it happen, but it might be a little bit more. So I'll usually use one of those, or if they don't want to do it, I'll pick one with higher estrogen that is just one that's like a third generation one, like orthotricycline or something in that class. And the higher estrogen ones do tend to work better than the low estrogen ones. So I'll try and avoid like the orthotricycline low or the other ones with low estrogen, because the estrogen is really what's doing the job here. It's helping increase sex hormone binding globulin. It's helping suppress ovulation, the generation of androgen. So it's really preventing androgens from reaching the oil gland. And so you want something that's going to be as good at that as possible, and while avoiding things that turn on the oil gland, like earlier generation progestins. So that's how I think about that. And then the nice thing about our other antiandrogens, like clascoterone and spironolactone, they're like hitting the other half of that. So the birth control pill is preventing the androgens from happening, and then the spironolactone is blocking them, the ones that are still there. So I think they really complement each other well. All right. Are there any more ones, or are there only two? Best regimen for pure non-inflammatory comedonal acne? Brandon, great question. I think for that, it's like benzoyl peroxide and retinoids are like the go-to thing. If it's just on the face, I think like adapalene benzoyl peroxide fixed dose combination is a great thing to start with, because it's often actually less expensive than getting both separately. It works really well, and it's very easy to use. People use it in the morning so they don't bleach their pillowcases. And then if they want to do something that they want to use at night, then you could do adapalene or tretinoin and a benzoyl peroxide wash in the shower, I think is a nice way to do it. And if it's more truncal, then you know, benzoyl peroxide wash is key. And when I think about benzoyl peroxide wash, I aim for the face 4 to 5%, because when you look at it, 10% is no more effective for treating acne, but it's much more irritating. So I go for 4 to 5% for the face. For the trunk, though, where irritation tends to be less of an issue, I often will try to get 10%, because sometimes people don't leave it on long enough, and I think 10% probably does work better there. And then I think using a retinoid for the trunk, I like tazarotene lotion because it's easy to spread and it's probably a little bit more potent than other topical retinoids, but really any one of them can work. So really like retinoids, and benzoyl peroxide I think are the best for comedonal acne. And then I guess there's this non-inflammatory part. When you histologically look at the comedones, there's inflammation in there, which is why actually a lot of people, instead of saying like inflammatory and non-inflammatory lesions, will classify them as papules and pustules and comedonal lesions to highlight that there actually is inflammation in comedonal lesions. What do you use as combo therapy with Winlevi? So if we think about like what is, Winlevi is clascoterone. So if we think about like what does clascoterone do? It's again, it's an anti-androgen. So it's blocking the effects of hormones turning on the oil gland. So I often won't use it, for instance, with something like spironolactone because they're a bit redundant in that job. I just would use like spironolactone alone. Or if they're on spironolactone, you could try to go to clascoterone to get off of spironolactone. But again, being an anti-androgen, the things it's not doing, it's not killing bacteria. So if there's a lot of inflammatory lesions, maybe you want an antibiotic and benzoyl peroxide in there. When we looked at the trial data, it's not so good at comedonal lesions. So you might want to use it together with a retinoid like tretinoin or adapalene, which is stronger at addressing comedonal lesions. They really complement each other in their strengths and weaknesses. So it's a bit about like what's the patient need, like you know, how many multimodal treatments do they need to get clear. If they have more severe, you need more. If they're less severe, you need fewer. What kind of lesions do they have? If it's more inflammatory, I might lean towards antibiotics and benzoyl peroxide. If it's more comedonal, I might lean towards benzoyl peroxide and topical retinoids. And just trying to, again, balance the side effects and share decision-making. Like someone with really sensitive skin, maybe you skip the retinoid. Someone who, you know, doesn't have the issue, maybe that's a nice thing to add. All right. Can you clarify your goal total dose at the end of ISO course? So earlier I said, I don't think I ever said 200 to 250 milligrams per kilogram. The way I do it is I start them at like 0.3 to 0.5 milligrams per kilogram. So that's often like 30 or 40 milligrams a day, or 20 if someone's really small. And then I will basically double that the next month when I see them. And then I might even go one notch more if they're not having many side effects. Because again, my goal is not to make them suffer. Like, they should not be having joint pains. They should not be like so dry they're like miserable. They'll be dry. Like, you cannot treat people without them being dry, but like, they don't need to be miserable. Like, I think a lot of people come in, they're like, this is gonna be horrible. I've seen my friends do it. I'm gonna like die while I'm on this. Any dose works. Low dose works, high dose works. And so from my standpoint, unless they really need to like be done fast because they're moving or something, or you know, you're worried about contraception and someone of childbearing potential, like there's no need to slam them with a high dose. It doesn't make them less likely to relapse, and it actually makes them less satisfied when you look at head-to-head trials of low or high dose. So I start them relatively low dose, kind of go until they have mild, manageable side effects. Everyone's different. Some people, they really want to keep it mild. Some people are like, just hit me with it. I just want to get done. You just kind of talk to them and find where that is. Once you get to that, I just stay at that until they're clear for about 2 or 3 months. So that's going to vary depending on how bad their acne is. Some people, they're going to be clear in 4 or 5 months. Some people, it might be 8 or 10 months, especially if we're using a lower dose for them. So that's going to be variable. And what we know is that treating to that clinical endpoint is the best predictor of staying clear, of not having the acne come out of remission. So getting to being clear for 2 or 3 months is a better predictor than cumulative dose, is a better predictor than daily dose. That being said, there are some studies that are like 150 milligrams, you're more likely to relapse than, you know, 120, you're more likely than 150, and 150, you're more likely than 220. Of course, right? You treat them with more, it's less. But again, I really worry about over-treating people, because that dryness, like when people get eye dryness, that doesn't always go away. If you've seen people who've done like multiple rounds of isotretinoin and like have permanent eye dries from that, that absolutely happens. And I think we have to be cognizant about those kinds of side effects. And so we don't want to overdo it. So 2 to 3 months of clear, and then I really try and stop. I do it to the dose I said was, I don't do less than 90 to 120 milligrams per kilogram. I think if you do less than that, like I have people who they just clear in like a month. If you just treat them for like 2 or 3 months, I think they do tend to relapse. So I do try to go like at least, basically it would be like 4 or 5 months, or at least like 90 to 120 milligrams. But I don't have some like top dose that I'm trying to go to. I'm trying to get them clear, however much it takes to do that. Do you recommend a probiotic for your patients on an oral antibiotic long term? Really interesting question. We don't really know the answer to this. Probiotic, we're going to talk about this event in the next session, may have some usefulness in treating acne. I'm not sure it necessarily like fixes the microbiome problems of oral antibiotics. There's certainly a lack of data to support that does it. Maybe theoretically it's nice to do. I think it's low risk to do. Like if someone wants to do it, fine. But I don't tell people like, oh, do this because it's going to help, because I don't know. I honestly don't know if it helps or not. Is there a struggle for getting sarecycline covered by insurance? Yes. My favorite is when they want the patient to fail doxycycline. Like, I've treated them like doxycycline 100 milligrams twice a day, and they're like, but have they failed doxycycline 50 milligrams a day? And I'm like, what? Why do I need to do that? They have to fail 3 kinds of oral antibiotics. And I'm like, well, we've done doxycycline. I don't really want to do minocycline because it's not safe compared to other things. Tetracycline is like, no one's used it for acne since like 1980. So like, what are the 3 ones you want me to fail in here? It's really annoying. I do find if you call them, like if you have the time to do it, you do a peer-to-peer, and you explain the data about sarecycline, that it has these, you know, potentially beneficial effects on the microbiome, that it may be safer, that it has less side effects. And then you ask them if they still don't want to do it, you say, okay, that's fine. Can I please have your NPI number, your like doctor number, because I want to put you in the medical record, because if you're taking care of this patient instead of me, I think you should be someone accountable for what happens to them. And then they almost always, because they're not a dermatologist, they panic, and then they just let you do whatever you want. So I find that a very effective strategy for any kind of like where you know something is the right treatment for a patient and the insurance is being really annoying, is say, I want to have your like doctor number, and then they freak out and they usually give it to you. So that's one thing you can do. I do think it's a little hard to get covered and very variable. Like in Massachusetts, where we are right now, Medicaid doesn't even have it on the formulary. So essentially there's no path to getting access to it for those patients, except sometimes if you call and beg for it. So that is sometimes a challenge. And I do think when this goes generic, it'll be incredibly useful. We'll probably use that as the only antibiotic we use for acne. Let's see, are there more? I have about a minute more of question answering if there are any more. And then again, if there are more questions, I can do them in the next part. At what age are you comfortable starting a patient on spironolactone? So This is an interesting question. We, at one point, actually, for another study, we polled 50 dermatologists, nurse practitioners, and PAs across the United States, and we asked them this question, and the median answer was 16 years old. So if you just want, like, a what do most people do, they'd say 16 years old. The way I think about it, and maybe some other people who treat a lot of acne think about it, is like, well, why are we worried about starting at a young age? We're kind of worried that, like, it might impair our ability to really understand, like, their sexual development and maturity, because now we're going to potentially give them regular periods or do things that might make us confused and makes it harder to, you know, assess things like androgens. And so for me, it's like, if they've been, like, post-menarche for, like, a year or so, and, like, something seems somewhat stable, or they might not quite be yet, but, like, they seem like they're doing okay post-menarche for a year or so, that's really the age where I think about it. So a lot of times younger patients, they want to do other things too sometimes, but that's the age where I'd start, like, it's reasonable to consider it, as once they've been like a year or two post-menarche. All right, maybe we can do one more, and there are other ones, I can do them in the next part. What do you say to people who want a baseline CBC at ICE initiation? I say, here's the evidence. There's really no evidence to support that this is helpful. If you want to do it and pay for it, fine. Not my problem. In general, like, patients want to do something, and it's not harmful to, like, anyone except their wallet, basically, I almost always say yes. Like, if they were like, can I take, like, 100 million IUs of vitamin A and isotretinoin, I'd be like, no, don't do that, that's dangerous. But, like, getting a CBC is not very dangerous. The main cost is to them financially. So if they wanna do that, I'm fine with that. I don't wanna not do it, and then, like, some weird thing happens, and then they're definitely gonna sue you. So if someone wants to do something that's, in general, for me as, like, a doctor, and it's a relatively safe thing to do, it doesn't hurt other people in a meaningful way, and I don't think it's, like, totally insane, I say, sure, that's fine. So I'd let that person get it. I'd say, I don't think it's useful, but if you want to do it, totally fine, let's do it. All right, well, I'm going to be back in a couple minutes, and then we're going to talk about nutraceuticals, and there will be plenty of time to do more questions then about anything about acne and rosacea, or anything you think I can answer somewhat effectively. So thanks, everyone, for your attention.
Ladies and gentlemen, the next set of track sessions will begin at 3:25 p.m.
Hope Cook with Dermcast TV. Do you spend a lot of time on social media? Well, we may need your help. We need help with content, creation, and editing. So if you're interested in volunteering with the Communications Committee, please reach out. Send me an email at hcook@dermpa.net.
Ladies and gentlemen, the program will begin in 5 minutes. Ladies and gentlemen, please welcome...